There are stories and pictures of just extraordinary suffering during the Cultural Revolution. Again, people lost their lives. People were beaten to death. Students turned on professors. Husbands and wives turned on each other. Some driven from real conviction about the need to, you know, move forward to this classless society and the belief that what was emerging was not good. Others simply, I think, trying to preserve themselves. If you didn't somehow demonstrate the proper fealty to the Chinese Communist Party, to the teachings of Mao Zedong, you would be attacked for that. And they were brutal in the sense that people were literally beaten to death in some cases and forced to march in the streets with these dunce caps and placed into jail. I mean, the number two to Mao Zedong, Liu Shaoqi, was jailed and died in jail. The party never makes a wrong decision. You can debate within the party, but once the party makes a decision, it's never a wrong decision.
There is so much interesting information about the life story of Xi himself and his dad. Maybe we can start the conversation there. What do we know about Xi's father? What's important to know about him? And specifically, what's important to know about his own time in re-education camps that, frankly, I don't think most Americans are aware of?
Sure. So, I mean, I think important to understand is that Xi Jinping's father, Xi Zhongsun, was one of the original revolutionaries in China. So he fought in the communist revolution and, you know, that emerged, he was part of the Chinese Communist Party and emerged triumphant in 1949 and helped to declare the new country of the People's Republic of China. So he was there at the inception of the new China. He was considered to be relatively moderate among the revolutionaries. He was in charge of propaganda at one point. But in fact, you know, in sort of the spectrum of sort of the revolutionary guard in China, Xi Zhongsun was considered to be somewhat more open-minded and a little bit more politically reform-oriented. During the Cultural Revolution, in fact, he was arrested and put in jail. So he, you know, was aligned at the outset with Mao Zedong. But, you know, over time, I think his views, his perspectives were much more moderate. And in the end, you know, cost him, you know, his position and again, landed him in jail. I think the impact on Xi Jinping, there were sort of Xi Jinping's life was actually fairly tumultuous in many respects. So again, you know, when Xi Jinping was born, he was born into a family that was quite powerful. And he went to school in Beijing for the children of the elite, for the top leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. But at the age of 15, as the Cultural Revolution was in full swing, Xi Jinping was sent down to the countryside. And so, you know, he went to live in a very poor village. You know, this was quite a shock to the young Xi Jinping. In fact, there's a story that after about 6 months, he ran away and ran back to, tried to run back to Beijing. But, you know, he was one of, you know, basically hundreds of thousands, millions of Chinese who were sent down to the countryside, who were considered to be part of, you know, the intellectual class or the leadership class that had been overturned during the Cultural Revolution. So Xi Jinping is stuck in this, you know, small village. He reads and reads. He spent a lot of time apparently reading. He also becomes, interestingly, very committed to the Chinese Communist Party. So you can imagine that someone whose family has suffered, remember his father's in jail, he's sent down to the countryside, that, you know, he might in fact turn on the party. But Xi Jinping becomes more committed and actually applies 10 times to become a member of the Chinese Communist Party and is denied. Finally, he's accepted he is able to go to university in Beijing and enters Tsinghua University. But at the time that he enters, Tsinghua University is not the Tsinghua University that is today, which is to say one of the premier academic institutions of China. It's a university like all universities in China, which are dedicated toward to educating the youth on how to be a laborer, how to be a soldier, how to be a peasant. There's no academic test to get in. And so he goes in at a time when the focus is on, you know, studying Marxism, Leninism, and ensuring that you're going to be a good revolutionary. So just a year or two later, the whole system is overturned. It's the end of the Cultural Revolution, and there are academic exams to enter universities, and you get a whole different class of student and a whole different education that emerges out of it. But so that's one reason why people sometimes say that Xi Jinping does not actually have a very good education, a very strong education, because so much of it was interrupted by the Cultural Revolution. Basically, his high school experience, you know, was in this village. And his university experience was dominated by not necessarily what we would consider to be traditional academic kinds of classes and instruction. So that's sort of the basic part of where Xi Jinping, you know, came out. He took advantage of once his father was rehabilitated at the end of the Cultural Revolution, he took advantage of his father's connections to get a position in the Communist Party. Working in sort of in a defense-oriented position as a secretary for somebody who was, a senior leader in the sort of the defense area. And I think what's interesting is that when Xi Jinping finally came to power, because his father had been moderate, because he'd been sort of oriented toward political reform, there were people who assumed that Xi Jinping himself would be that way. And so there were a lot of articles being written in the media, the U.S. media, about how Xi Jinping was going to be a reformer because that's who his father really was. Of course, that turned out not to be the case. And frankly speaking, within 2 months of taking power, it was clear that Xi Jinping was not going to be a political reformer. But some people decide couldn't move away from that notion that like father, like son.
Yeah, this fascinating background, and for people that have heard the phrase Cultural Revolution as it relates to China, I'd love to give a little bit of space to refresh people on what that means. And I'd also love to give some time to let you talk about what we might know about how Xi's father trespassed against, Maoist ideology in a way that led, I think he spent something like 8 years in a re-education camp. Anything you might like to add some color to those details, I think might be helpful for the audience.
Sure. So the Cultural Revolution, basically it was a period of extraordinary upheaval in Chinese society. And part of what happened was that at the end of the 1950s, Mao Zedong had unleashed the Great Leap Forward, which, put in place these radical notions of, agricultural reform. China was going to leap into communism. And so, they melted down forks and knives, right, in this rush to produce steel. And they basically tried to leapfrog socialism to get to communism. And so established these, widespread communist collectives where, people basically gave up their children, in fact, in some cases. Yeah. So they really, this was a big moment of transformative change. And, Mao Zedong was trying to prove that China was a leader, in the communist world. It was vaunting ahead of the Soviet Union. And it cost, 30 to 40 million Chinese their lives. And at the end of that, Mao Zedong was pushed to what people will call the second line, which means he had to take a step back. And instead of being the sort of paramount leader of China, he became one within a collective of leaders. And that at that moment, people like Xi Zhongsun, like Liu Shaoqi, there was an entire cadre of officials who, were more favored, just a sort of a bureaucratic approach to developing socialism, sort of step by step, build up the Chinese economy. But for Mao Zedong, that looked a lot like what had been, and in fact was the antithesis of communism. And so after a few years, so we're talking now 1960, 61, 62, you're sort of getting the bureaucratization of China. It's beginning to look more like a traditional state without the revolutionary fervor. The ideology is becoming, if not corrupted, not as central in many respects to the functioning of the Chinese polity and economy. And by 1964, then, Mao Zedong is very disgruntled. He's really not, you know, in charge in the way that he had been. And so he calls for this cultural revolution, which is basically for the youth and the revolutionaries to overturn this bureaucratized society. And so that echelon of leadership, of which Xi Jinping's father was one, you know, basically was arrested. They were arrested. They were put in re-education camps. They were sent to jail. Some died in jail. Deng Xiaoping, you know, was jailed during the Cultural Revolution. He eventually became the leader of China. So there's that element of sort of what we would consider to be more traditional leaders all found themselves, you know, out of favor as the country basically went into turmoil. And it wasn't just leaders, it was professors and anybody who was considered to be sort of, you know, a part of the traditional elite. And, you know, there are stories and pictures of just extraordinary suffering during the Cultural Revolution. Again, people lost their lives, people were beaten to death, students turned on professors, children turned on parents, husbands and wives turned on each other. You know, all in an effort, you know, some driven from real conviction about the need to, you know, move forward to this classless society and the belief that what was emerging, you know, was not good. Others simply, I think, you know, trying to preserve themselves. And Xi Jinping ended up on the wrong side of that divide. Throughout the Cultural Revolution, again, like many other in the Chinese elite.
Yeah, there's a couple facts I want to read out that I came across in preparation for this conversation that I wanted to share and then get your opinion on a specific point. And please correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but that from the 1950s until the mid-1970s, China suffered 25 to 45 million deaths from famine and mass purges or murder. I watched a documentary that referred to this time as China's Holocaust. These numbers are absolutely staggering and I don't think are widely appreciated in the West in the same way that the actual Holocaust was, where far fewer people died. You know, Mao is still an icon in China. I've been to Tiananmen Square. His picture is still there. I don't think it's too far of a stretch to say that it would be akin to having something like Hitler's picture in Berlin. Obviously, different ideologies, but the amount of suffering the man caused was almost beyond words. You use this word already in this conversation that these people were revolutionaries. And I know 1949 is a really the beginning marker of the modern Chinese communist state. I'd love to give you some time to unpack the psychology of these men. You've mentioned Mao a couple times. Why it was that they were so convinced that Marxism, that communism in general, was worthy of their lives. I've heard Stephen Kotkin put it this way, that in unleashing the Soviet archives, that the big takeaway is that these communists were communists, that they, in their private letters, spoke like real believers. And I think to a Western audience, we're not particularly well informed about why it was or how it could be that people committed themselves to this movement in the way that they did in the face of all of this suffering. I'd love to give you some time to unpack that in whatever way and however much time you'd like to give to try to explain that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's sort of two different parts to it. I think the first is sort of the longer history of how, you know, communism, Marxism, Leninism, you know, took root in China and then, you know, led to that commitment that you're talking about. And in some respects, you know, it's not that difficult to understand, because you had a country where, you know, the ruling dynasty, the Qing, was corrupted. It was weak. It had fallen behind the West in terms of science and industrialization. And so you had, you know, a group of Chinese intellectuals who were seeking alternatives to Confucianism, right? Which is what was sort of the governing structure of values, both moral and political, in China. So they were looking for alternatives. And I think like Europeans and others globally, there was a group of Chinese intellectuals who became very interested in Marxism at the turn of the 20th century. They translated the Communist Manifesto early on. That's the sort of, call to arms, the, description of class struggle that was, drafted by Marx and Engels in the 1800s. And so you had this group of intellectuals who were kind of imbibing this philosophy. And then you had the May 4th movement in 1919, which was, a set of demonstrations, basically, against the ruling class at the time, but also it had everything to do with the Treaty of Versailles, which, let Japan keep territories inside China. You had a period where all these students, for example, were marching and demonstrating. It was a combination of Chinese nationalism, but also, again, this desire to find an alternative political value system for the country. And so you had this group of kind of dedicated communists that emerged out of these two periods of time. And then you had the engagement of Russians and the Soviet Union. So the Soviets, proved to be instrumental in both developing the Chinese communist ethos and the party itself over time, through the 1920s. I think, that's a big part of the story. That they supplied, ideas and organization and some financial support, throughout this period. They had a very interesting thing happen in China, where you had the ruling party at the time, the Kuomintang, the KMT, and the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, align. And so they basically, the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, accepted the communists into their party, but the communists governed themselves separately under the umbrella of the KMT, I think, which is very unusual, right? And that lasted, for a few years in the 1920s until Chiang Kai-shek, who was the leader of the nationalists, broke, in part because the Chinese communists continued to be influenced and shaped by the Soviets. So you now had an external power also influencing what was happening inside China. And then there was the Shanghai massacre, and which a lot of communists died at that point in time. And then you had a break and, in essence, you had civil war until you had the threat of the Japanese invasion. And then they united again, the KMT and the CCP. So with an external threat, they came together again in the mid-1930s. And, it's interesting. So they're fighting the Japanese on the one hand, right? We're now in World War II. On the other hand, they're still fighting each other a little bit. And the communists are continuing to mobilize people, even as they're fighting together, the Japanese. So it's a very complicated story in some respects. But I think what people responded to with the communists, China was a very classist society, virtually impossible to move. If you are a peasant, you are never becoming part of the ruling class in China during the Qing, right? So what the Chinese communists, promised, they promised land reform. They promised, a better life. They promised, in some respects, social mobility. They promised a voice, right, for the peasants and for the laborers who had never had a voice in China. Yeah. And that's something that the Nationalist Party did not promise. And so I think that is really, one thing about the Chinese communists that differed from the Soviets and from, frankly, the way that, you know, communist revolution was supposed to take place was that it was rooted in rural, in agrarian China. And so I think, to me, you know, there's people had been oppressed, right? Very deeply oppressed, with no opportunity for advancement in their lives, no opportunity for their children to advance in their lives. And so I think it's not that difficult, I think, in that context to understand why people were willing to give their lives for change. And, you know, could it have been a different kind of change? Could it have been like, you know, the American Revolution, you know, and where they could have ended up with a democracy? You know, it wouldn't have been impossible. But what people grafted onto and what people, you know, pursued and made appealing, you know, to the broad masses in China was this notion of, you know, class struggle and, you know, equality, egalitarianism, you know, at the end. And I think a lot of people found that to be very appealing.
Yeah. Hope, right? I mean, it was basically a story of hope for people that had terrible options.
Yeah, exactly. It was the promise of something different, something that would benefit them, a group of people that were arguing for them. The Chinese Communist Party was very successful in growing itself, right? Throughout the 1920s and 1930s, it was a very attractive message with people who clearly weren't afraid to work hard, weren't afraid to, you know, to give their lives, right, for this cause. And so I think ultimately that's why they were successful.
Yeah. I want to go into some more detail about the specifics of the Cultural Revolution. And again, just as an amateur dipping my toe into these waters, it looks like a form of self-sabotage and eating a movement from within. Some of the details that I learned in the last couple of weeks about what happened in that country in the 60s and the 70s. And I'll bring it back to Xi specifically because I came across a fact that his half-sister killed herself because of her exposure and the stress from struggle sessions, as I understand it. And I'd love to give you a little time to describe what these, I mean, some of the video footage I saw of students turning on students of, you mentioned this before, families turning on one another, the wearing of dunce caps publicly. I didn't realize how common that was in that time. Talk about, in whatever detail you might like, the struggle sessions, some of the darker aspects of the Cultural Revolution that, you know, led to this this almost like purity test and the movement almost seeming to eat its own.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is what it was, basically. It was a purity test, but there was no way to emerge out of it, you know, in safely, depending on the position that you held, right? So if you were a professor and you were found with books from the West, right? Or if you had criticized the government or, you know, promoting any kind of alternative theory, you know, you were immediately attacked for that. If you didn't somehow demonstrate the proper fealty to the Chinese Communist Party, to the teachings of, you know, Mao Zedong, you would be attacked for that. And they were brutal in the sense that people were literally, yes, as I mentioned, beaten to death in some cases, and forced to march in the streets, you know, with these dunce caps and, you know, placed into jail. I mean, the number two to Mao Zedong, Liu Shaoqi, was jailed and died in jail. I mean, you know, he was the second most powerful leader in the country. He was maybe the most powerful when Mao was sort of pushed back to the second line. So this was, I mean, the viciousness and the sort of, I think, loss of, you know, sense of what was right and what was wrong, it was a kind of, it's the wrong way to put it, but a kind of mass hysteria that I think overcame the country where people lost all perspective. And, you know, and it was the empowerment of people who, you know, without any background or training, you know, where all of a sudden became, you know, a few of the most powerful people in the country, you know? I mean, somebody, you know, who had, you know, worked in a cotton mill, right? It's one of the most powerful people in the country. Wang Hongwen, it was unimaginable, frankly, what happened. And I think this period of time, you know, was really seared into the memories of people. You had, you know, people who were sent down to the countryside to be what they called barefoot doctors. You had, you know, physicists who were sent to work in factories to understand, right, the labor that other people were undertaking, right? Because somehow, you know, being a physicist had basically returned you to the pre-revolutionary period, where, you know, in Mao's eyes, China was reverting back to that class-based society that had, you know, the objective of the communist revolution had been to rid, right, the country of those kinds of classes, right, of the capitalists, you know, of the intellectual class. But, you know, during that early period of the 60s, in Mao's mind, these forms were coming back into place. I think that was part of it. I think part of it was simply that Mao Zedong had lost power, you know, and he wanted to reassert his own leadership too. I don't think there was any small measure. It was no small measure. This was about Mao Zedong himself. So you had to perform self-criticisms. I mean, that's been the case, you know, throughout. That continues to be a part of Chinese political life, is self-criticism, you know. So in front of your, you know, coworkers, saying what you have done wrong, how you have not been, you know, sufficiently committed to the party, right? Mm. Any transgressions you may have committed against the party, you know, between the Cultural Revolution and the advent of Xi Jinping. So that, you know, pretty significant period from the late 1970s through to 2012, those kinds of self-criticisms became very pro forma. Right. And I think, you know, people were eager to leave behind the Cultural Revolution and all of the things that accompanied it. But Xi Jinping, you know, would speak out against sort of the formalistic way of doing self-criticism. I mean, I've had Chinese friends, you know, that when they would talk about it, they would laugh. Right. And they'd say, you know, people would just go around the room and say, yeah, you know, I did this. And it would be something completely meaningless and people would laugh. But with Xi Jinping, that's no longer the case, right? He reintroduced the notion that you need to take this seriously, this self-criticism. Mm. So I think it was a very dark period of time. And there were some efforts in that reform-oriented period pre-Xi Jinping to, you know, memoirs were being written about the Cultural Revolution. But because a premium is placed in the context of the Chinese Communist Party, that you're never wrong, right? So the party never makes a wrong decision, right? There's democratic centralism. You can debate within the party. That debate does not go outside the party. But once the party makes a decision, it's never a wrong decision. And so constructing a narrative, part of Xi Jinping's mission has been to construct a narrative that is inclusive of all of Chinese history. So that means the Cultural Revolution must be incorporated. You know, sometimes people say, oh, mistakes were made, right? But basically, we couldn't have gotten to this point without that. So I think it's a, you know, a tough needle to thread. But there certainly is not the space now for people to be, again, writing memoirs of their experiences during Cultural Revolution, to have open discussions about what transpired. You don't find that in China today.
Yeah. And you know, there is no due process, right? I mean, the people that were accused of trespassing against the party, was it akin to like a witch hunt, where as if an accusation was leveled against you, by default, you were assumed to be guilty of some crime, some thought crime or otherwise?
Yeah. I mean, there was no, yeah, as you say, there was definitely no due process. I mean, people were yanked out of their homes and, you know, beaten without cause and, you know, dragged down the street. And I mean, maybe there's a list of ostensible crimes that you know, they're read out publicly, but there's no chance for someone to defend him or herself against those, against that list of crimes. I mean, you know, judges, right, with legitimate legal training were among those who were you know, being arrested. And so you ended up then, too, with an entire generation, an entire legal profession. And this is something that China had to overcome over the past 30 years of, you know, people's judges. So, you know, a retired, you know, sanitation worker can be a judge, or anybody can be a judge in a Chinese court. So now it's much more professionalized again. But for a long period of time, that was the case. And so because, you know, there's no rule of law in China, so no presumed, you know, innocent until found guilty in China. So I think, yeah, that was definitely the case. There was not an opportunity to defend yourself against accusations.
Well, just for an average person to live in that environment and know that at any day, on any day, someone could accuse you of the most asinine charge and your life could be over, that the amount of fear that people must have lived in. I mean, obviously, there are a ton of parallels to me to Stalin times. I don't know. I'd love to have you talk to that. What it must have been like for an average person to witness living in this insanity and how they would try to preserve themselves in this chaotic environment.
I mean, to be frank, I don't think I can give an adequate, you know, sense of what that would have been like. I certainly, you know, wasn't in China, you know, at the time. I was too young to be studying China at the time. And I don't, you know, I can only, you know, imagine as well as anybody else could imagine what that would have been like. I mean, I do think even today in China, or certainly at the outset of the Xi Jinping era, there was a sense, a little bit of a sense of witch hunt. I think the anti-corruption campaign, when, you know, he started going after people and arresting them, and, you know, the conviction rate is 99% in China. So it's not as though, you know, for the people that are brought in, and you know, I don't think that there's, again, much room for, you know, once Xi Jinping has targeted you, you know, as corrupt or as having done something against, you know, the interests of the party, you basically know you're going to be facing a prison sentence of some sort. So I think, you know, even today, the surveillance state in China, which is so, you know, vast, that does inculcate a sense of fear, maybe not on a daily, you know, as you're walking about, you know, but you always have to be mindful of what you're saying, of what you're putting in your WeChat account. I mean, think of it this way. You know, the Chinese government has put in place a law that says that even, you know, you or I, you know, if we tweet something or we write an article or we have this discussion and say things that the party considers to be antithetical to its interests or somehow looking to undermine the party, if we go to China, we can be arrested. So even though what we're doing and saying is here in the United States, so that's the degree to which the party, quite frankly, feels vulnerable, right? It's really brittle that it can't withstand any criticism from the outside.
Yeah, that's a great, I mean, I didn't know that. That's insane. I want to read something to get back to Xi's story and go along with his chronology, just to put some context as to how poor that country was in the 1970s. And I believe this is roughly correct, that the state of China's economy in the 1970s, this is when my parents were in college, adjusted for inflation, was $800 to $1,000 a year or a few dollars a day. You told that story about Xi going to that rural, almost like cave-like environment where he lived for many, many years and studied. And my understanding of his eventual trajectory, and I think you alluded to this earlier in the conversation, was that he atoned for his sins, quote unquote, and came back as a real believer. in the system itself. And I want to maybe talk about his trajectory into who he's become today. I know that he, I believe, led the 2008 Olympics as sort of like a trial run to his ascendancy to even greater power. But maybe if we can start with that moment of him acquiescing to the party line and deciding that, you know, I think you talked about how many times he was applying to get into the party, that he wanted to get in. He wanted to be part of this movement. And it seems like he bought into the system, which to me as a Westerner sounds like he bought into this massive lie. But tell that story about how he ascended from obscurity at those times living in the middle of nowhere to who he is now.
Right. I mean, so I don't know whether you want to say he bought into a massive lie in the sense that he bought into a system, right? Yeah. It's a system that, you know, he came to understand and he came to appreciate that he could maneuver within that system successfully, right? So, you know, after, you know, he had a very rapid rise actually through the party and was sent to a number of provinces that were quite successful, that were rapidly growing. And under his leadership, they continued to grow. He was not known as a reformer per se. There were other leaders of his generation who, you know, there was one, Li Yuanqiao, for example, who like held debates among potential cabinet secretaries and televised them. Others, you know, did online chats with people in their provinces. Xi Jinping wasn't like that. He was known to be relatively quiet, to listen to, you know, different debates, not make clear his position, and then come down on some decision. So I would say he wasn't a creative leader who actively propelled whatever province he was leading to sort of greater heights, but he didn't rein them in and like make them not grow. The one thing that he was pretty consistent about was talking about anti-corruption. So yeah, that was fairly internal to him. He often spoke about how officials should not use their positions for personal, economic, or political gain. So I think, and that's something that he's carried all the way through to becoming, you know, the general secretary. 2008 Olympics was considered, you know, a big triumph, of course, for China, and the fact that he was put in charge was, I think, probably instrumental in his eventual accession to the top position. I was in Dubai at the time when they announced the leadership. I was with a lot, just happened to be in a meeting with a lot of Chinese former officials and intellectuals, about, I'd say, 40 or 50 of them. And I can say that there was surprise at the announcement, that a lot of people didn't really seem to know very much about Xi Jinping at the time. He was a little bit of a mystery, not only to Westerners, but also to a lot of Chinese, right? They didn't know a lot about him. But he pretty quickly made his views and policies known.
There's the word that you used earlier, that the system is brittle, that it can't, you know, it's doing everything it can to mitigate the risk for criticism. And one little quick funny story I have to bring up in researching this conversation was about, I'm sure you remember this, when there was a viral image of Xi looking like Winnie the Pooh. What happened there, and what does that say about the system in general and him as a man?
Yeah, so this was just, you know, he looked a little bit like Winnie the Pooh.
He does, yeah.
No. You know, particularly in profile. And so it was a meme. And frankly, a lot of Chinese thought it was pretty funny too. But there's no room for making fun of Xi Jinping, for, you know, even just gentle teasing. that's not the nature of the system. And, you know, part of what Xi Jinping reintroduced was the notion of, you know, sort of the singular leader, right? Because after Mao Zedong, you know, one of the things that Deng Xiaoping did was to say, we're going to have a collective leadership and we're going to limit the presidency to 2 terms. So you could be general secretary of the Communist Party, you can be chairman of the Central Military Commission for a longer period of time, but we're always going to guarantee that there's going to be the peaceful transition or transfer of power through the presidency. But Xi Jinping upended that, of course, changed the constitution so that he could, as he does now, serve a 3rd term at least as president of the country, chairman of the Central Military Commission, and general secretary of the Communist Party. So hold 3 of the most important positions all in his own hands. He developed a cult of personality around himself. And so songs about Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping thought 150 institutes devoted to the study of Xi Jinping, an app that Chinese Communist Party officials, you know, where they have to take quizzes about Xi Jinping, about his thought, about his activities. And then they get scored and they have to report those scores to the local party, you know, whoever's in charge of, whether it's university, you know, the local party head of the university or the hospital or whatever it might be. So that you can imagine that someone who actively encourages those kinds of activities takes himself pretty seriously, and being likened to Winnie the Pooh, you know, it doesn't fit into you know, Xi Jinping's self-image.
When I've seen him give speeches and do interviews, he looks almost like a robot to me. I mean, he's so stoical and very little expression on his face. His tone rarely ever changes. This is one thing I knew I wanted to go over with you. Like, I'm guessing you've thought a decent amount about this. How do you make sense of this man's personality, if he even has one? What's your takeaway about who he really is, if we can even discern that?
You know, I mean, that probably is a million, 20, 30, 40, $50 million question. I mean, the person that can unlock Xi Jinping, the internal, you know, dynamics of Xi Jinping. I think we know some features that define him. We know that he is committed to, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, to having a strong Chinese Communist Party. We know that he, feels threatened by Western ideas. I mean, one of the things he's done is to really try to close off, China to, you know, foreign textbooks, right, in universities, et cetera. They have cameras in some classrooms, you know, to make sure the professors, kind of, again, a modern techno version of what was taking place, around the time of the Cultural Revolution, making sure that everybody's adhering to the Xi Jinping line of thought. There are no dissenting opinions. No criticism of Xi Jinping is permitted. So I think that bespeaks someone who is, you know, quite defensive. And in some respects, you know, perhaps insecure. People say he doesn't know anything about economics, for example. Within China, people say this. And that helps explain why, you know, we haven't seen China be able to move out of this current, several year now economic slump. He's unwilling to, you know, sort of experiment in ways that a lot of reform-oriented economists want. I think we can see that he is a lot about control. And this is something that, you know, I've written about, that he's in any area where you see sort of the free flow of information or the free flow of capital, he's very quick to clamp down. So all of those big technology companies, you know, Alibaba and Tencent and Baidu, you know, we saw several years ago where he cracked down on them. You know, they got rid of basically online education. Again, partly because, you know, it's outside of his control. People, who knows what those people are teaching, right? What are they doing? I think that's an element of him that's important to understand, the issue of control. I think he's consumed with returning China to greatness, right? From the moment that he stepped on the podium in 2012, you know, in that initial new Chinese leadership lineup and gave his first speech, you know, he talked about the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, returning China to, you know, centrality on the global stage. And I think that is important. I think that vision of China, you know, recreating the notion that China is at the center and everything radiates out from there, I think does help us to understand what he's driving toward. And I think, you know, that's been now 12, heading to 13 years that he's been in power. I think you can see that. You can see the kind of progress that he's made. You can see what he's tried to do. He's very clear about what's important to him. And I think that notion of returning China to, you know, its imperial greatness with Xi Jinping as the emperor, basically, has, you know, a lot of attraction for him.
Yeah. It's on the one hand, it's an amazing story over the last 30, 40 years, just because of how many hundreds of millions of people have been able to escape abject poverty in that country. And it's probably the fastest ascendancy out of poverty of one group in all of human history. On the other hand, a lot of what you just talked about, the surveillance state, the inability to hold elections or remove people from power who shouldn't be in power to criticize. I did an episode a couple years ago about the situation of the Uyghurs in Western China. There's evil there. And I know no one knows the future. And we're about to get a new president in our country. I'd love to give you some space to put on your probabilistic hat and give what you think might be coming if you had to bet in the next 5 or 10 years. Obviously, people are concerned about Taiwan, about economic trade wars. I'd love to give you some time to speak to that and any detail you might like about what you think is likely or quite possibly on the horizon here, specific to China and the relationship between China and the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, let me say one thing about China itself. I do think it's important to recognize that, you know, China's facing an, you know, economic slowdown. It doesn't mean that Xi Jinping is in any way attenuating his foreign policy ambitions. I think it's important to recognize that he's continuing to push forward on Taiwan, continuing to push forward on his big development initiative, the Belt and Road, continuing to push to try to de-dollarize the global economy. So even as at home, he's facing a lot of challenges on the economic front, he is not dissuaded from his global ambitions, from that great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. At the same time, I think we've missed a little bit of the picture in terms of what's taking place societally in China, because I think there are more cleavages, there's more polarization to some extent in China than we might appreciate. You know, cleavages around gender, right? The huge, you know, crackdown on feminists in China. There's obviously, you mentioned the Uyghurs, so divisions along ethnic lines, the Han Chinese versus the ethnic minorities who've been very repressed under Xi Jinping. Urban and rural divides. You know, rural China is not faring well, and it's not simply an income divide, it's an opportunity divide where rural education has not progressed. So you're looking now at an entire class of hundreds of millions of people who are not really going to have access to the 21st century economy, you know, other than maybe being, you know, someone who's, you know, driving a delivery, you know, cart in a city. So I think, you know, that's another issue. And I think the divide between the creative class and the bureaucratic class. So people whose job it is to think outside the lines. So the intellectuals and the entrepreneurs, artists, all of these people have really suffered, you know, during the Xi Jinping period. And you see now, you know, an exodus of these people and communities of Chinese now springing up in places like Tokyo, right? Mm-hmm. Big expatriate community in Tokyo filled with entrepreneurs and intellectuals, lawyers, people who are raising their children and conducting their lives as though they were living in a democratic China, although they're in Tokyo, right? So I think there's a time of reckoning domestically that China is going to come to as you continue to have this economic slowdown. So the one thing that people could hold on to, right, which was greater economic opportunity for them, for their children moving forward. If they don't feel that, the question arises, what do they have? Right? Because they don't have an open system. They don't have the ability to voice their opinions freely. They don't have the rule of law. They don't have the opportunity to get rid of Xi Jinping in an orderly process. So I think, you know, that could produce, you know, some more disturbances, I think, grassroots disturbances than we might anticipate today. And then finally, in terms of the U.S.-China relationship, you know, look, flashpoints are certainly Taiwan and the South China Sea, the Diaoyu-Senkaku Islands with Japan, anything related to the sovereignty issue, the territory that Xi Jinping considers to be Chinese sovereign territory that he wants to reclaim, I think has the potential to be highly problematic as China continues to develop its military capabilities and its military strength. I think it's, you know, it poses a serious challenge for us. You know, is there the opportunity to find some new form of accommodation between the United States and China? And I think it's going to be difficult unless one side or the other is willing to compromise its values. Because fundamentally, this is a competition among two different visions of systems. And it's not simply that China, you know, has a repressive surveillance state at home. You know, it does try to, you know, export its values. It wants, you know, to have its rules, you know, its norms spread throughout the rest of the world and in global governance institutions. And so this is a competition. It's a real competition. And doesn't mean we can't try to work together on issues like climate change or, you know, global health. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have commercial relations. I firmly believe we want our companies. I want Starbucks selling lattes in China. I want McDonald's doing business. I want all of them there. I think they're great brand ambassadors for the United States. I don't want a cessation of you know, contact. I want Chinese students coming here. And I desperately want American students to go to China to learn Chinese, to learn about the culture, the history, the politics, because, you know, in 10 or 20 years, we're going to miss a whole generation of people who understand this incredibly important country. And I think that would be tragic. So I want all of that connectivity to remain, but I don't want us to be blind to the real competition that is underway and, frankly, to the necessity of the United States, you know, emerging on top of that competition.
Concur with that. I'd love to close with one final question that's related to what you just said. And that is, you know, and I don't know where you come down on this competition between America and China. I would assume probably you are in the pro-America camp. But for an average citizen who might come across this, who agrees with that, that for all of our flaws, our system is the better one for many reasons. What can we do? What should we know? What can we encourage our government to do to try to end up ascendant in this competition? I know Niall Ferguson has framed this as Cold War 2.0. And I don't know if you generally see it in those terms, but what should people, or what might people who come across this, who are just curious about what they might be able to do, how they might be able to influence their country, America, to change
things? Honestly, yep. I think the most important, maybe there are two really important things we can do. I don't believe in fear mongering.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't want a witch hunt in our own country, either against Chinese or Asian Americans, or even Chinese who are here as tourists or working or, you know, doing things. I think that's the wrong way to go. And I don't want us to focus on how do we stop China. I want us to focus on how do we run faster and how do we make ourselves better. And I think in that context, you know, investing in ourselves is the most important thing we can do. And so whether we're talking about something like the CHIPS and Science Act or the Inflation Reduction Act, which is about pushing the U.S. into the clean tech sector, or, you know, bipartisan infrastructure law, making sure all Americans have access to broadband, I think all of these things that, you know, are core to our own economy and to our economic development and our competitiveness over the 21st century, to me, that's the number one thing that we can do, is to invest in ourselves and make sure that we can compete, invest in innovation, invest in science and technology, invest in our educational system. Then, of course, I think there's the bigger issue, frankly, of how we come together as a nation and as a society, and how we heal ourselves, how we heal the rift, you know, the political rift that has emerged, I think, within our society. I think that's critical for us. And frankly, it's critical for our image on the global stage, because it's very hard to sell the notion that the United States should remain, you know, the global leader and has a system that others should be attracted to and should want to emulate, when you watch and see some of what's happening, I think, today in our society, in our political system, in our media. I think, you know, that's a really big issue that I think we need to tackle.
Yeah, very good. Liz, I appreciate you. This was so good. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Dan. It was a pleasure.